On the day of her wedding, Edith had woken earlier than usual, her senses alerted by the quality of the light, which was hard, white, and uneasy, harbouring surprises of unpleasant nature, far removed from the mature sunshine on which she had been counting. She took the weather as an omen, and her abrupt awakening as a sign, though of what she could not say or even think. More to the point, as she passed her dressing table, she caught sight of her face and was shocked to see it so pale and drawn. "I am no longer young," she thought. "This is my last chance. Penelope is right. It is high time I forgot my hopes, the hopes I was born with, and faced reality. I shall never have that for which I long for with my inmost heart. How could I? It is too late. But there are all the comforts of what is called maturity. Pleasant companionship, comfort, proper holidays. It is a reasonable prospect, and I was always a reasonable woman," she thought. "We are all agreed on that. And Geoffrey Long, that kind man who had been produced for her at that not-too-distant dinner party, and who had been so lonely since his mother died, what more excellent guarantee could anyone produce of a safe and sensible future? Only a very innocent man," she thought, "could play the traditional suitor so openly. And how impressed everyone had been, principally Penelope, but in the end even Edith herself, by his devotion, his generosity, his endless flowers, his fussy care, and finally his mother's gloomy opal ring. And he had offered her a complete life, a new home to move into, new friends, even a cottage in the country, luxuries which she would never have thought to procure for herself. And he was a personable man, if a little old-fashioned his views. He did not, for example, approve of women working, and he teased her about the amount of time she gave to her books. And there was something so agreeably straightforward, even comic, about his courtship. And everyone said how good he had been to his mother. Everyone said how lucky his wife would be. Everyone said how lucky Edith was. Penelope said it with that faintly nettled air that implied that she herself would have been a more worthy recipient. And Edith was constantly reminded of her good fortune. And, really, there was no need to disclaim any of this. She was lucky. "I am lucky," she reminded herself, looking at the drawn face in the glass of her dressing table. She made herself a very strong pot of tea, and while she was waiting for it to draw, she opened the kitchen door to inspect her garden. But there was a small and niggling wind which blew a tiny shower of dust around her ankles, and the door kept swinging backwards and forwards, interrupting the curious light, bringing intimations of clouds, although there were no clouds, and a cessation of things to be taken for granted. Like this little house, so long her private domain, a shell for writing in, for sleeping in, silent and sunny in the deserted afternoons. Before the children came home from school and turned it into another gateway. Those becalmed afternoons when the strength and heat of the sun on the window at her back merely drove her relentlessly typing fingers onwards as if they had a life of their own. And the ensuing exhaustion always signalled by an alteration in the light, which returned her to herself and to her tense back and shoulders and her slight cramp and an awareness of untidy hair and smudged hands. And with this awareness, a disgust, as if something organic had taken place, whilst the children were coming home from school. Then, leaving that room, she would go down to the kitchen and open the back door, sniffing the heavenly, the normal air whilst waiting for the kettle to boil, and would take her tea in the plain little white bathroom, where she would wash away the day's fatigue and residue, and hang up the simple cotton dress she wore for working in, as if only some unassuming garment were appropriate for her daily tasks. that illicit manufacture of substance not needed for survival. And in her bedroom, a cool room which got the morning sun only, and then, for a brief period, she would dress herself carefully and brush her hair, as she had been taught to do so a long time ago, and pin it up with the usual unthinking expertise. And when she had judged herself gravely in the mirror to be presentable, she would go downstairs, pour herself another cup of tea, and at last feel ready for the garden. She would miss the gardener most, she thought, although she was not really a gardener. Most of the work was done by a taciturn and alarmingly pale boy from the greengrocer's. What he lacked in words, he made up for his passion for plants and his assiduity with which he cared for them. He came 3 times a week in his lunch hour, and she would leave his lunch on the kitchen table. She tried to tempt his appetite, worried about his white face, and although he longed for a cheese roll and a bottle of beer, he swallowed her careful delicacies, sensing this was important to her and taking it seriously. "I'm off now," he would call up the stairs. "Might look in on Sunday." "All right, Terry," she would call back. "The money's on the dresser." For the money seemed to them both a separate issue, hardly connected with the loving work of housekeeping to which they both, in their different ways, applied themselves. The garden was only truly hers in this very early morning and in the evening, after her day's work, when she simply sat on a rather uncomfortable wrought-iron bench, a kind gift from Geoffrey, who had laughed at her old, spreading, creaking wicker chair, and watched the sun dip below the hedge and welcomed an increase in the sharpness of the scents. At this time, she knew her neighbour's child, a child of heartbreaking beauty, whose happiness and simplicity were already threatened by a crippling speech defect, would come out to see if she were there. But she was always there, and would slip through the hedge to say good night, and Edith would watch her wrestling with the words, her thin little body judging with the effort to unlock them, and she would smile and nod as if the words were perfectly intelligible, and would put her hands to the child's jerking head to still it, and would whisper, "Good night, my little love. Sleep well," and would kiss the child, now calm, and send her off to bed. The evenings were less interesting. A visit to Penelope's to hear about the day's events, a small meal, half of which Terry had had for his lunch, and plants to be watered, and then bed, very early. Sometimes it was still light when she went to bed, but as the light was of such great interest to her, she would put down her book just to watch it fade, the change colour, and finally become opaque and uninteresting. Then it was time to sleep. Her bed was white and plain, not quite big enough. Geoffrey Long, a sturdy man, and winksingly, but this his usual good nature, remarked on this more than once, as had Penelope, whose own bed would have accommodated 4 adults, and which, when not in use, was heaped with all manner of delicate little pillows covered in material which proclaimed to the world at large, "I am a woman of exceptional femininity." Some women raise altars to themselves, thought Edith, and they are right to do so, although I doubt if I could carry it off. In any event, the marital bed at Montagu Square, where Geoffrey had formerly lived with his mother, had already been installed, and soon she would take her place within the confines of a handsome bedroom, the colours of which she secretly found a little too intense. She had chosen them herself, but had, fatally perhaps, evoked the aid of Penelope, who had guided her expertly through a selection of department stores whilst discoursing on the ways to please a man. "It's no good being wishy-washy, Edith," she had said several times. "A man can't feel at ease in a cell. You have to recognise his needs." Edith, feeling faint in this airless world and apologetic because she found so little to arouse her enthusiasm, and because Penelope seemed so much more involved in the enterprise than she was herself, succumbed at last to her persuasion, and although to the terribly thin face of the poor salesman whose lunch hour they were monopolising, and chose a counterpane of dull marigold with expensive marigold-coloured towels to hang in their dark green marble bathroom and some thick satin-bound blankets, the colour of cinnamon. They were new and handsome, but it seemed to her that they absorbed the light and were stuffingly authoritative. She could not see herself repairing to this bedroom after a day's writing or taking a nap on the splendid cane-headed bed. And she had noticed precious few children in Montague Square, and there was no garden, so that today would have an entirely different pattern when her writing time was over. But then she would not be writing. Perhaps she would never write again. She would have that life that she supposed other women have, shopping, cooking, arranging dinner parties, meeting friends for lunch. All those worldly acquaintances who had been so kind with their invitations to little gatherings and whom she had hitherto repaid only with a desire that they should see her garden. "I have not paid my dues," she said to herself on a day when she had looked with timid pleasure at her new and spacious kitchen. "I must have seemed like a foundling to them. That will have to change." And it had changed. No one had been hurt. On the contrary, everyone was delighted. David had laughed at her new recklessness and had teased her with an unknown lover. "You must be in love," he had said. And she, not daring to break that unwritten contract between them, had not said what she wanted to say and had missed her chance forever, so that when he had taken her hand surreptitiously one day at a private view to which she had gone with Penelope, and she had guided his thumb to her third finger where he had felt the rim of Geoffrey's mother's ugly ring, he had stiffened but had said nothing. What was there to say? There had been no promises. And later that evening, on their last meeting, he had pressed his face into her neck and mumbled, "Do you mean it?" And she had meant it, because sometimes he stayed away too long, and because he had not dissuaded her. But a month later, on her wedding morning, she was still standing in her kitchen, thinking of all the things she had not yet said to him. The sound of a key in the lock had made her start. Her regular cleaning lady, Mrs. Dempster, pink-cheeked, brilliantly coiffed, generously sober, looked at her in amazement. "Not dressed yet," she marvelled. "I hope you've had your bath, at least." "Why?" asked Edith. "What time is it?" "It's 10 o'clock, articulated Mrs. Dempster, slowly, as if to a child. 10 o'clock. You're getting married at 12, remember? And in case you're wondering what I'm doing here, well, there's a little matter of the catering to supervise. You remember that, I suppose? You're coming back here for a buffet lunch, in case it slipped your mind, before you sail off into the blue." She breathed hard as she donned her spotless overall, as if the very prospect of marriage unsettled her nerves, which were notoriously unpredictable. Men were her downfall, and she had confided over many cups of coffee. Very little work was done. Edith suspected that Penelope got more out of her, but then she conceded Penelope had more to offer in way of confidences. Penelope and Mrs. Dempster, in fact, had something in common. Their entire conversation revolved around the subject of men, who they seemed to like and to dislike in equal measures, so that when Mrs. Dempster said, "Come on, love, you have your bath and I'll make you a nice cup of coffee to have whilst you're dressing," Edith had turned away, tears pricking her eyes. The kindness of people, she thought, the unexpected kindness. Lying in her bath, she could hear the house reverberating to Mrs. Dempster's voice, commanding a troop of men. Cases of champagne were dumped rather heavily somewhere beneath her. The promised cup of coffee had been postponed in the greater excitement of supervising the arrangement. The little house shuddered with the iron roads of florists and the team of girls who would now turn the kitchen into their own domain as they manufactured the asparagus rolls and the mushroom vol-au-vents and the tiny cheese beignets and the ice fingers of orange cake and the nestle road pudding. "Pudding, Edith, you must be mad," said Penelope. My mother loved it, countered Edith, and thought privately that her mother would have considered this a puny alliance. Girls with high but severe voices could be heard demanding more vases or calling from the back to the front of the house, Sarah, do get a move on. We've got to be out of here by 11:30 if we're going to the Tregenter Road. Oh, coffee, you angel, Mrs. Dempster. Sarah, coffee! And there was suddenly a complete cessation of activity, as if they had decided to call the whole thing off. But when Edith went back to her bedroom, she found a cup of coffee on her dressing table, and in the saucer, a couple of biscuits, which Mrs. Dempster must have brought with her, for Edith did not remember buying any. She dressed in the fine stockings and the beautiful grey satin slip. She had rejected Penelope's offer to oversee her wedding clothes and had gone in a series of unaccustomed buses to an elderly Polish dressmaker in Ealing with some fine blue-grey material in a mixture of silk and wool. And here she was, dressed in a very credible Chanel copy, the jacket bound with a dark blue and white silk braid. Mrs. Wieniawska had also made her a plain round-necked blouse, which she wore with her Aunt Anna's pearls, her only dowry, the only token of her family's presence. Her shoes were blue and white. She thought a little too high in the heel, and she carried her white gloves. She had refused to wear a hat, but had twisted her hair up a little higher than usual, and when she looked in the glass, she was pleased with herself. She looked elegant, controlled, grown up, she thought, at last. A faint sensation of pleasure, the first she had felt that day, began to suffuse in her, and her face wore a welcome and naive smile as she descended the staircase. Sarah and her friends, Kate, Belinda, had no time for her, and Mrs. Dempster was engaged in meaningful conversation with Penelope at the kitchen table. Penelope, Edith was interested to see, was wearing an obviously expensive dress of printed silk, an enormous red straw hat, the brim of which curved under her head and skimmed down the sides of her face nearly to her shoulders. A strong smell of scent emanated from her many pleats and folds. A mother's famous diamond earrings were in place, touched from the time to time by her fingers with long scarlet nails. This outfit had Mrs. Dempster's full approval. It was indeed radiant, nuptial, although it formed a strange contrast to the hefty, denimed haunches of the girls intently rolling almond biscuits round the handles of wooden spoons. Whatever Penelope had been discussing with Mrs. Dempster was instantly abandoned, and Edith found herself the object of their stern and almost disembodied scrutiny. Who would carry the day? She wondered, with almost equally disembodied interest. Penelope, with her emphatic knowledge of what a man really likes, or me, blessed only by my genius of my Polish dream seamstress? If there were a man here, he would reenact the judgment of Paris, except that if that man were Geoffrey, and now it could be no one else, he would find something acceptably gallant to say to all of us. The silence was broken by one of the girls who was turning out her wedding breakfast with surprising speed. Oh, jolly nice, she said. Look, would you mind moving? Only we want to be out of here pretty sharpish and would like to clear up. Good luck and all that, she added. So Edith had been reduced to walking round the garden whilst Penelope and Mrs. Dempster continued to oversee the girls in the kitchen and to hope that Edith realised how lucky she was, working on the mutual understanding that in her case such luck was not to be taken for granted, and was not even all that deserved. In a dream half the time, observed Mrs. Dempster, making up those stories of hers. I sometimes wonder if she knows what it's all about. Penelope laughed, and Edith, seeing this through an open kitchen door, wondered if she might be allowed to share the joke. My dear, I'm the one with all the stories. She was in time to hear Penelope say, I wonder she doesn't put me in her books. I have, thought Edith. You did not recognise yourself. But she was tired and chilled and rather hungry. She felt as if she were emerging slowly for some debilitating illness and might at any moment be prone to headaches and fits of tears. It seemed to her that she should be wearing something warm and shabby. A dressing gown would be ideal. And sipping a nourishing milky drink. She felt acutely alone, and thought that perhaps many brides felt the same. But surely few brides were left to sit in the drawing room on their best behaviour, occasionally getting up to look out the window to see if the cars were arriving. And when the first huge gleaming car did arrive, was it the duty of the bride to walk back to the kitchen, now hot and friendly, and announce, "Penelope, your car is here"? For it had been decided, Edith could not now remember by whom, that Penelope, as matron of honour, should be the first to arrive at the registry office, and she should there join forces with Geoffrey and his best man, who was a larger but sleepier version of Geoffrey himself, and that they would thus be ready to welcome Edith, who would arrive 15 minutes later in a second car, alone. Mrs. Dempster, at her own request, would stay behind, using Edith's bedroom in order to change into her own highly distinctive wedding outfit and would be there to welcome them home and do the honours of the buffet. After Penelope had been persuaded to depart and had taken her time over it, enjoying the impassive gaze of the small group of crisp-eating children waiting outside the house, there was a moment of calm. The girls trooped out, already intent on the time and calculating the distance to Tregenster Road. Mrs. Dempster could be heard upstairs running water for a bath. Edith stood in the window, and then, all too soon, it was her turn. As her own car drew slowly away, Edith fell into somewhat regressive state of mind. Details of her little house front struck her as if she was seeing them for the first time. It should have been painted, she thought. And then I really ought to have done it. And then she noticed the extraordinary charm of the shops which passed unseeingly every day. The funeral parlour, the chemist, the newsagent, with his discreet display of adult magazines, most of which had covers which showed girls bending over and winking through their legs. The beating shop, with its mass of torn paper tickets littering the pavement outside. As the car rolled her on towards her destiny, she noted with deep nostalgia the Cypriot greengrocer emerging from the depth of his shop with a bucket of water. This was flung in a wide arc over the pavement, causing Edith to feel a shock of pleasure. She saw the hospital and the young men in white coats charging up the steps, and the adventure playground, and the day nursery, and the place that sold plants, and one or two pubs, and a rather nice dress shop. And then she saw the registry office, and a small crowd chatting on the pavement in front of the entrance. Like a visitor from another planet, she saw her publisher, and her agent, and her poor father's crazy vegetarian cousin, and several of her friends, and quite a few neighbours. And she saw Penelope, animated, her red hat attracting the attention of one or two of the photographers, conversing with the best man and with Geoffrey. And then she saw Geoffrey. And then she saw in a flash, but for all time, the totality of his mouse-like seemlessness. Leaning forward, in a condition of extreme calm, she said to the driver, "Would you take me a little further, please? I've changed my mind." "Certainly, madam," he replied, thinking from her modest demeanour that she was one of the guests. "Where would you like to go?" "Perhaps round the park," she suggested. As the car proceeded smoothly past the registry office, Edith saw, as if in a still photograph, Penelope and Geoffrey staring, their mouths open in horror. Then the scene became slightly more animated as the crowd began to straggle down the steps, reminding her of a sequence in some earlier masterpiece of a cinema, now preserved as archive material. She felt like a spectator at some epic occurrence, was prepared for short shots to ring out, fatalities to occur. But soon, amazingly soon, she had left them all behind. As if to signal her escape, the sun came out and blazed hectically. And with the full heat of the late fall summer behind it, over Sloane Square. And then they were preceded at a steady and stately pace through the park. Edith opened the window and breathed with ecstasy the fresher air, giving delighted attention to the little boys playing football and the heavy girls thumping up and down on horseback, and the tourists peering at their maps and presumably asking the way to Harrods. Once more she begged, but now her exhilaration was beginning to fade at the thought of the consequence waiting to be faced, confronted her. By now, everyone would be back at the house, Geoffrey seated in the drawing room, possibly with his head in his hand. Mrs. Dempster, grimly demanding what she was to do about the food, Penelope masterminding the entire proceedings. This time she noted that the leaves were turning and the sky becoming overcast again, and that she felt very cold and, regrettably, still hungry. After that, it had all been terrible. She found her little house vibrant with indignation. Although she was glad to see her publisher and one or two of her older friends sipping champagne in the garden, she crept upstairs to her bedroom but found it littered with Mrs. Dempster's clothes and smelling of Mrs. Dempster's scent. Downstairs she could hear Penelope saying, "Do help yourself to everything. At least we can offer you some food." I cannot think where Edith has got to. She must have been taken ill. At which Edith had sighed and made her way timely down the stairs, very much aware of the indelicacy of her appearing at all. She made her way straight to the drawing room and put her hand on Geoffrey's shoulder. "Geoffrey," she said, "I'm sorry." He looked up and with momentous dignity removed her hand. "I have nothing more to say to you, Edith," he pronounced. "You made me look a laughing stock. I think, Geoffrey, that you will find that it is I who am the laughing stock." This he ignored. "I am only grateful that my poor mother did not have to live to see this day." They both looked at the opal ring, which Edith removed and handed to him. Then she said, "Goodbye, Geoffrey," and left the room. "I shall be in the garden, Penelope," she announced, thus provoking a renewed wave of scandalized excitement. "I just want to have a word with Harold and Mary." And taking a glass of champagne, she moved into the garden, exchanged a few pleasant words, but no explanation, with her agent, and sat there until she was sure that everyone had left. She was condemned out of hand, of course. For what seemed like hours, she listened to Penelope and Mrs. Dempster discoursing on her moral turpitude, her childishness, her lack of dignity, trust, loyalty, and decent feminine sensibility. She then heard them tell her that she had had a last chance, that there was no future for her in that line, whatever she may think, that they wondered how she could hold her head up, that the best thing she could do would be to go away until she had come to her senses and could make decent reparations to society for the outrage she had committed. She had listened to all this in silence, her head bowed, until finally the voices had stopped and the steps had retreated and the front door banged and she was alone. She waited for 5 cautious minutes, then made her way indoors to the telephone and dialed a number. "Stanley," she said, "is David there?" "Doing a sale in Worcester," was the reply. "Anyone could have done it. I don't know why he went. Could you get in touch with him for me? Could you ask him to come round this evening as soon as possible? It's Edith, by the way." "Didn't you get married then?" asked Stanley, unsurprised. "No," she said. "I changed my mind." She went upstairs to her bedroom now, restored to her, but still smelling of scent, opened the window and changed out of her beautiful suit into a blue cotton dress. She sat on the bed for perhaps half an hour, contemplating her disgrace. Then moving to the window to close it, for it was now evening and chilly. She was in time to see Geoffrey emerging from Penelope's house and looking decidedly more cheerful. Gone out to book a table, she supposed. 2 hours later, she sat in the dark waiting for the sound of David's car. Her mind was emptied, but she was filled with longing, a longing which she now perceived to be fatal. For this misdemeanour could hardly be overlooked, when it would inevitably cause a whole chain reaction of amusement, caution, withdrawal. Quarrels can be made up. Embarrassments can never quite be forgotten. Edith foresaw, sadly, that she would become an embarrassment. Yet David, when he came, took her in his arms and said nothing. When he released her, he held her at arm's length and looked at her. She saw strain in his face and tiredness and knew that she had caused both and something else. He looked rueful, wary. The situation was too complicated, too loaded for the unwritten contract between them to bear. For they were reasonable people, and no one was to be hurt, not even with words. Above all, not with words. And so, with her last ounce of energy, and that rapidly disappearing, she made a joke of it. An accident of timing, she said. Poor Geoffrey had been a stand-in. What she really needed was a holiday. Clearly she was not cut out to be a married lady, but they might as well finish the champagne. And, in the end, after watching a lugubrious film on television, he was quite relaxed, and they were loving again. But she noticed with sorrow, after waving him goodbye, that he had not touched the plate of little delicacies she had salvaged for him from the wedding breakfast. She had set out the next few days, waiting to hear from him, but plans had to be made in her name, and when the telephone rang, it was Penelope, with the name and address of this excellent hotel, and information about flights, and what to pack. It had seemed to suit everyone that she should disappear, and to make sure that she did so, Penelope monitored her every movement. She was allowed out to have lunch with her agent, and to leave him her address. For it was now grimly assumed that henceforth she would have to live on her wits, or at least by her pen. And on that last grey day, summer quite gone, she had found herself unresisting in Penelope's car on the way to the airport. Mrs. Dempster had promised to come in the following day to give the house a finer overhaul and to return the key to Penelope. She could not see her way clear, she explained, to coming back. She was funny like that, sensitive. Edith would have to make other arrangements. But as the car had drawn away, Edith had been comforted to see Terry, paler than ever, making his steady way along the pavement with a box full of bedding plants. He raised his free hand up with his spare key in it. When he saw her, and she had waved back, at least she thought the garden would be cared for.